Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
It seemed like more than just bands, you know, putting out records. It was like a movement.
All right. Hello, everybody. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. Welcome to another episode of our show. Thank you all very much for listening. On behalf of my co-host and great friend, Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you to an episode where we're going to discuss I wouldn't really call it a label, and I wouldn't really call it a group. I would call it more of a collective. And here to discuss that with me is a voice I'm sure you are all familiar with, Mr. Scott Parks. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you, Patrick?
Doing well. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. And also, helping drive the concept behind this idea. It's you were listening to some of this music and kind of came up with this concept. So tell everybody what the collective we're going to talk about is.
Sure. Yeah, we're going to discuss the Elephant Six Collective, otherwise known as the Elephant Six Recording Company, even though, again, it was never really a real full-fledged label. I think they did release a couple of things under that name. But like you had said, it's more of a musical collective, a collection of like-minded and like-sounding bands that kind of grew up around this core group of four individuals that knew each other in high school. So the Elephant Six Recording Company.
Elephant Six. And it's very interesting. And to me, one of the things when I first started listening to this music in the, I guess, mid-90s or, you know, mid to late 90s, was how strong the influence of 60s pop music was, right?
Exactly.
I mean, the Beatles and the Beach Boys and all those kind of bands that were in the first wave of discovering what you could do in a studio and what you could do with, of course, for the Beatles and the Beach Boys, at the time it was very groundbreaking, but some equipment that at that point had become available to everybody, like four-track machines and you know, fairly rudimentary recording equipment, eight-track recorders. And they were fascinated with this kind of technology and what they could do with it, right? So that was a really strong influence.
Exactly. And yeah, I didn't discover them until a little later. I think it was probably around 98 or 99. I know it was after In the Airplane Over the Sea had come out. And I discovered it pretty much how I discovered most music back in those days, through Napster and downloading things. And it was almost like a found sound for me. Like I had found this old album that had been recorded decades earlier, even though it had literally just come out, you know, maybe a year or 6 months before I found it. And a lot of the music from Elephant Six is like that, where it sounds old. And at the time, you know, harder music was popular. Obviously, grunge came about in the early 90s and continued to get harder and harder and harder as the 90s went on into the 2000s. And the Elephant Six was almost like the anti-grunge movement to bring music back to a more poppy sound versus the hard-edged music that was coming out of the Pacific Northwest and other areas of the country.
Yeah, that's a great point, because it definitely was kind of flying in the face of you know, like you said, what was the prevailing sort of mainstream alternative sound at the time. And definitely was an inward looking thing. They weren't paying a whole lot of attention to what was going on in other places.
Yeah, I mean, I think I read something about Robert Schneider, who was one of the main people, and he basically just hated everything. He hated indie rock. He hated you know, anybody, like commercialism, and he just wanted the Elephant Six to be this perfect pop collective of people that didn't care about commercialism, didn't care about any kind of naming, any genre. They just wanted to kind of live in their own, you know, way and do things the way they wanted to do it, versus, you know, again, what happened with grunge. All of these bands got signed and then the major labels came calling and all of these other bands came out of the woodwork. They were completely against anything to do with commercialism and attempting to make it. They just wanted to make the music that they loved, and it was based on music that they grew up loving as you know, kids in the 70s and 80s.
One of the interesting things I think about this musical collective, the recording company Elephant Six, is that unlike, let's say, Sub Pop or Merge Records, or, you know, name any sort of scene that has taken place in the past 20 or 30 years in indie music, it wasn't centered around a town. And as you mentioned, the main movers and shakers all went to high school together in Louisiana.
Correct.
Which is an interesting thing to begin with. And then two main hubs developed, right? One in Athens and one in Denver, Colorado. So
correct.
It was really another unusual thing about them, that it was spread out in these different geographical locations.
I've never heard of any, you know, music label or any, you know, I don't even know what you would call it, but like scene, music scene. Like, they had a music scene that was completely all over the entire United States.
Yeah,
there were bands
amazing.
That were from San Francisco. There were bands from, you know, I think Brooklyn. There was at least one band from there. They literally they basically were looking for bands that sounded like them, and they said, yes, you can become part of Elephant Six. It wasn't always about being invited or saying you wanted to be there. They would find a band that sounded like what they were doing, had similar ideas and beliefs, and they would incorporate them into this collective, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, and that's another cool, fascinating thing about it too. And I remember in the Discord scene in DC when I was growing up, it was almost like you needed to know somebody, even if you played in a band that sounded like, you know, those groups, and you wanted to do that, and you went to all the shows and stuff. It was almost, you still needed some sort of an entree into kind of a little bit of a close circle. But in this case, very different. People, they would just hear bands, or people would send them tapes, and that would suddenly be enough for them to be kind of considered brethren in this group.
Right, exactly.
What do you think the main people you want to talk about? What are the groups or the people who, you know, are the main figures in this collective?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, the four people that kind of started Elephant Six, they all came from a small town called Ruston, Louisiana. They all went to high school together. Those four people are Bill Doss, Will Cullen Hart, Jeff Mangum, and Robert Schneider. They played music together, and they originally used the name Elephant Six for their home recordings that they had made while they were in high school and while they were living in Louisiana. I did start a book called Endless, which is a kind of an overview of the Elephant Six recording company. I'm not very far in it, but I guess they did work at a local radio station, and you know, they had a lot of connections together and with other like-minded folks. And then when they got out of high school, like you had mentioned, some of them moved to Georgia in Athens, and some of them moved to Denver. Robert Schneider being kind of considered the godfather of Elephant Six, he was one of the ones that moved to Denver and started the Apples and Stereo, originally just called the Apples. And they were the first group that actually released anything under that Elephant Six umbrella. They released an EP called Tidal Wave, which that's also a song that is on their debut album. And I would consider Tidal Wave to be one of the three or four songs that if you listen to it and you like it, you're going to like the majority, if not everything else that the Elephant Six collective is about. It's very poppy. It's very Beach Boys, very Beatles, a little bit of Zombies thrown in there. It's not what most people would consider lo-fi, because it doesn't have that lo-fi crackly sound that a lot of indie bands, you know, did around then. It sounds very produced, but it was completely done by themselves. That's another thing. Elephant Six is all do-it-yourself. They aren't about anybody coming in and producing them. It was literally all self-produced. Robert Schneider even created his own recording studio called, I can't remember what that was called. I'll find it. It was called Pet Sound Studio. So if that tells
That's
you anything,
right. Yeah.
Pet Sound Studio, and a lot of the Elephant Six records were recorded there in Denver at Pet Sound Studio. So Robert Schneider again had the Apples in Stereo. The other three, Bill Doss, Will Cullen Hart, and Jeff Mangum, they formed a band called the Olivia Tremor Control, which would be the second band that I would consider to be one of the mainstays and one of the bands that you can listen to their music. And if you hear, you know, some of their songs, you'll hear a lot of the same sounds in other bands. The song from them that I would consider to be another one of the benchmark songs is called Hideaway. From their second album, and it sounds a lot like a lot of other bands that released things, you know, either around that particular time or later, and it's really good. And Jeff Mangum, he also, in addition to being in the Olivia Tremor Control, he kind of had his own solo project that I'm sure most people will be familiar with called Neutral Milk Hotel, that ended up becoming more of a band, but it originally started just as a project for him to get his music out there, and his, you know, basically solo recordings. I think a lot of the early stuff was literally just him and an acoustic guitar. So those three bands, the Apples in Stereo, Olivia Tremor Control, and Neutral Milk Hotel, are kind of the three linchpins of the Elephant Six. And if you like them, you will like everything else, probably, that is kind of grouped into this collective.
I would concur. I pretty much am exactly in that space. I love all the three of those bands, and I like almost everything I've heard that's kind of come out on Elephant Six too, which is really cool.
And I haven't even listened to most of it, honestly. There's on their official website, they list 47 bands, but I believe it's known that there's at least 50, if not a little bit more than 50 bands that at one point or another were considered to be in the collective, in the Elephant Six collective.
One thing that's interesting too that I think makes it sort of difficult to, you know, again, with the geographical thing and with the number of releases, there was also, you know, as you mentioned about Jeff Mangum, he was in multiple groups. I mean, he did some work with Elf Power as well, and some other stuff. So there was some intermingling of personnel there that kind of created a little different projects.
Exactly.
There.
Especially in Athens. I had read that basically they all lived together. They spent all of their time together. So all of these bands were a very incestuous type of relationship between bands, where they would be in multiple bands. They would tour with each other. One band that might have become a little bit bigger would bring one of the smaller bands on tour with them, even if they weren't just from Athens. If they were just considered part of the collective, it was kind of more like a family, especially in those individual hubs. They were kind of more seen as, you know, brothers and sisters with each other, just because they were local. They had the same mindset and the same beliefs, and would play with each other and tour with each other.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting that the bands that you were talking about that had sort of concurrent sounds that became sort of folded into the collective were from, well, at least in two cases that I'm thinking of, were from pretty established music cities. There was a band called Beulah that was from San Francisco. And then there was two bands, the Essex Green, who was a very, very good band, and Ladybug Transistor were from Brooklyn. Right. And yet they were kind of accepted and sort of became part of this, you know, intermingling of things, too.
Exactly, yeah. And Beulah, talk about Beulah, that's one of my favorite of the Elephant Six bands.
Yeah.
And it's a band, they are a band that should be more well-known. If you are a fan of the Beach Boys, you will be a fan of Beulah. The harmonies that they sing together, and just, you put a Beulah album on and you just have a smile on your face. If you listen to some of the lyrics, I mean, it's kind of, the lyrics are pretty dark in certain cases, but it's the case where you have a happy sounding song with dark lyrics, which I know Jim is a big fan of. But I really love Beulah a lot. They're one of my favorites.
They're an excellent, excellent group, and I envy people that get to discover them, like, for the first time, who are Beach Boys fans or Beatles fans, and they're just going to be like, wow, this is incredible, you know, update on all that stuff.
Right, and talk about the Beach Boys, I think from what I had read, the main album that these, that they were kind of obsessed with was Smile, like the Smile Sessions, and, you know, at that point, back in the 80s, it was never released, it had never come out, it was really more of like a holy grail, you know, you would hear about this album that Brian Wilson made after Pet Sounds that he went completely crazy and never finished, and you might hear snippets here and there. Obviously they released Smiley Smile, which took some of the sessions and they put some of those on that album, but I don't remember when the Smile Sessions came out. I think it was probably right around the late 80s, early 90s when they were able to get a hold of it, and they just kind of went nuts, and you can definitely hear that on a lot of the mid 90s Elephant Six records. It's the harmonies are just so tight, it's incredible. I love it.
You know, that's such a great insight too, because a lot of times when I was thinking about this or listening to those bands, it's almost like they're trying to imitate or pay homage to music that they'd never heard. So they're trying to imagine what some of this stuff that they knew was recorded but never were able to hear would be like.
Yeah.
And it's pretty fascinating. In many cases, they get so close to this magical brew of all the stuff. Like, what would Brian Wilson's mind have been like, and what would he try to do at this point after Pet Sounds?
Exactly.
And that's really cool. And just in that sense, it's really fun to listen to a lot of these groups. And I will tell you, too, that Scott has put together a playlist, or a couple of them, actually, and we'll try to get those out when this episode is published as well, so you can dip your toes into certain things.
I'll probably have to pare down my some of my playlists, because I basically tried to get every album that might be considered Elephant Six, and I have two playlists that are each one entire day long. So we might need to pare it down, and we'll figure something out and get that out there around the time this publishes.
We will, yeah. Depending on how deep you like the water and which end you like to jump in. Let's talk for a little bit, Scott, about Neutral Milk Hotel.
Yeah.
And we're probably going to do shorter episodes where we focus on kind of the arc of a band's career and maybe go in-depth a little bit on certain albums and songs. But Neutral Milk Hotel gained a popularity beyond what the other groups did. And certainly, at least from my perspective, it was not an intentional thing whatsoever. It just sort of happened to them.
Well, and I think it probably...
Talk a little bit about
that. Yeah, sure. You know, just again, from where I come from, I had never heard of any of these bands ever before until I got a computer after I graduated from college in 1998. High-speed internet, which at that point was not really so high-speed, but it was better than dial-up, and Napster. So those three things, time, computer, and high-speed internet, plus my love of music, I kind of went nuts, and I just started trying to find everything I could. and I stumbled onto In the Airplane Over the Sea from somewhere. I don't even know exactly why I found it or how I found it. And like I mentioned, it was kind of like a found sound that, you know, kind of what I look for now when I go to a record store and I'm digging through the crates and you look for an album cover and you're like, man, that's a really cool album cover. I'm going to grab that and take it home. Same thing here. I pressed play on this and I couldn't believe what I was hearing, especially when I found out, you know, when it came out, that it wasn't super old. And I think what happened is there were a lot of people like me that were doing that, trying to find music that had never, they couldn't find because they had access to it now versus before. I grew up in Indiana, middle of nowhere Indiana, and you don't have access to a lot of the same stuff that you do if you live in a big city or on a coast. So I have a feeling a lot of this was organically created where someone discovered them similar to the way I did it or from a friend or whatever. And it blew up, and it actually kind of made Jeff Mangum go a little bit insane.
It did.
He was on, you know, a lot of speaking tours. He was, you know, doing a lot of press, and he then became a recluse and just disappeared and stopped. You know, I wish that wouldn't have happened. I wish he would have had a little bit more time to delve into some more of his, you know, the music that was inside him. But he basically just quit after In the Airplane. And from there, we've never heard anything else recorded, at least from him. He has since come back out and has performed live a few times. But yeah, it wasn't wanted. He definitely did not want to become a rock star.
Absolutely. And of course, like you said, a big factor in all this was how good that record was. I mean, it's an incredible achievement. It really is. Just everything that he had been working on and the way it was produced and how it all came out. And like you said, that amazing album cover, you know, with the lady and the small figure with the drum head for a head, and everything all just came together at the right time. And certainly I think file sharing had a lot to do with it. But I remember I was on the Merge mailing list for a while, and I got the first Neutral Milk Hotel album, which is called On Avery Island, and I thought it was just fine, and there was a couple cool songs on there. The first track of Song Against Sex is an amazing song, and several very, very good songs, but it wasn't one of those things where I was like, this is going to change indie rock, you know, for the next 20 years, and very few hints of what was going to be the next album. Like, there were sharp, I mean, you can do it in hindsight now and go back and connect the pieces, but if that was the only album they ever put out, they probably would have been, you know, a decent little indie band, but it just changed everything.
It did. And it really, in my personal opinion, it changed music moving forward, because it allowed people understand that you can make music that doesn't sound like anything else. And Neutral Milk, it's a band that I think sounds the least like the majority of the Elephant Six bands. He honestly could have, it's like his own little offshoot of Elephant Six. It allowed people to understand that you can make music that isn't commercial, isn't really like poppy, isn't using just standard instruments. I mean, there's pipes and a singing saw and what is it? A zanzithophone or something like that. I mean, there's super weird instruments, but it's just, it's incredible. I listened to it again this morning, and every time I listen to it, it's hard for me to believe that it exists, that it's a real thing.
Know.
And it allowed people that listened to it, that were creative, that were maybe afraid to release music that didn't sound like everything else, it allowed them to understand, I can do this. I can make it as, you know, a musician, even if I don't want to be, you know, like a consumerist, I can at least put something out that has value that people will listen to and will love for decades and decades and decades, which is what's happened. I mean, it's awesome. I love it.
Really well said. And, you know, like you mentioned, like not believing that it was old or that it came from some, you know, obscure figure that put it out and put out nothing else. I mean, the content on there, it touches on the Holocaust, and it touches on themes of ghosts and you know, flying over edges of balconies and hotel, you know, roofs.
Right.
And it's just got this otherworldly, ethereal kind of quality to a lot of songs. And I think another thing about it, too, is that you could sit down and play them if you knew how to play a little bit of guitar, or you could, you know, like you said, it was at the time when chords started circulating on the internet and was pretty easy to find, you know, a lot of these chords, and you could sit down and sing those songs by yourself.
Right.
And
yeah, because I'm sure that
was an incredible
thing.
That's
what he did, I'm assuming, before recording it. He could have just been like singing around a campfire. I mean, most of his music is not like very hard to understand and play in regards to, you know, the chord structure and whatever. It's very simple. But whatever he does to it, he's got this magic dust that he sprinkled over it, and his voice is incredible. It's hard sometimes to even listen to it and believe that it's real, like that it's a human being sounds like that.
Yeah, it's stunning. And if you haven't ever heard it, boy, you are in for a treat. And it probably would be right up there for contenders for one of the most, you know, the best and most important albums of the entire decade of the 90s, for sure, especially considering its lasting influence. I mean, like you said, he did go into a period of withdrawal and retreat and didn't do any music for a long time. And then when he came back, I don't know if it was in the early 2000s or whenever that was that he took place, but he did a few benefit shows here and there, and he made very selective appearances. But literally, people were, you know, standing there in the audience with tears streaming down their face with that same feeling, like, I can't believe he's here, you know, and he's actually playing and I'm getting to experience this. That's how deeply it touched
people.
Exactly. Yeah. Really amazing. So briefly, by the early 2000s, there was a bit of a slowdown in the activity of Elephant Six, right?
Exactly. Well, the Olivia Tremor Control went on hiatus, Neutral Milk Hotel, obviously, Jeff Mangum, you know, kind of went dormant. A lot of the bands, if they did continue, they kind of didn't continue as being considered Elephant Six. So the Elephant Six kind of, I wouldn't say it died, but it did kind of go into an inactive, stagnant phase. But some of the bands did continue on making music. Apples and Stereo did. Elf Power is still around now. I think they just released an album last year. I think they're touring right now, if I remember correctly. There's another band of Montreal who we haven't talked about yet. They're from Athens.
That's right.
And they're still going strong. Even though it really wasn't what it had been in the mid to late 90s. There were still some bands that were going, but a lot of the bands just ceased to exist altogether. I think Beulah, they released their last album in 2003. It was called Yoko. Obviously Olivia Tremor Control didn't, Neutral Milk Hotel, you know, gone. I would say the majority of the bands probably only lasted from the mid 90s to the very early 2000s. And by the time the mid 2000s rolled around, there were probably only, you know, 3, 4, 5 bands that were still in existence.
Exactly. And one of the cool things about it as a collective is the fact that the bands who were in that scene were not necessarily so dependent upon that label or that tag that they couldn't continue.
Right.
And you cited great examples there. And so that was another cool thing. A lot of times if there's a scene or, you know, a like think about Sub Pop, you know, to use an easy example, in the grunge, like outside of that, a lot of those bands, there wasn't enough, you know, without the rest of the bands and the movement for them to kind of continue on their own or grow or change. Right. And these bands certainly did that. Of Montreal is a great example of a band that's put out a lot of records and continually went in interesting directions and, you know, got into all kinds of different sounds based on from what they originally were.
Right, correct.
You know, one thing that I think that's interesting, Scott, too, about Elephant Six, and we're going to talk about how they sort of made a little bit of a reemergence, comeback kind of a thing later on in the decade of the 2000s. But it's amazing that they were able to communicate with each other as well and as consistently. And even if you weren't living with someone and 24 hours with them all the time. But this was pre-internet. I mean,
or at least pre-internet today. Like it was. It's pre-social media, pre-everything, everywhere at once in your face all the time.
Right.
I 100% agree. Like just reading about this collective, it is hard to believe that they were able to keep it going even for the, you know, probably a little bit less than a decade or around a decade that they did, having so many mm-hmm. different bands in so many different areas, when it wasn't just easy to just communicate with somebody like it is today. I 100% agree, and I was thinking the exact same thing. I don't know how they did it. Even if you were in the same city, it wasn't as easy as it is today to communicate with somebody. There was no texting, really. It was, you know, pagers, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe that's what it was. Yeah, I remember carrying one of those around for a few years. You got to find a phone somewhere to call somebody
right,
back.
Right, exactly.
And so I do think, you know, you outlined really well sort of why everything sort of started to wind down. And certainly that was also around the time that online, you know, media, the Pitchforks of the world started to emerge in the early 2000s. And they wrote a lot about Elephant Six, and I think some of them may have felt slightly uncomfortable about being pigeonholed as whatever
exactly.
they were pigeonholed as, you
right.
know, and that's always a problem too.
Yeah, and again, I think that had a lot to do with, you know, kind of some of the bands wanting to distance themselves from being considered, you know, in the collective at that point. So, you know, most of the bands kind of either continued on not considering themselves Elephant Six, or a lot of the bands just stopped. But in the later 2000s, there was a brief reemergence, like you had, you know, mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
Apples in Stereo was recording an album in 2007 called New Magnetic Wonder. And it actually was the first one that had the four original members, probably I think since their second album. I think after their second album, they had some lineup changes. So that was the mm-hmm. first one, and while they're recording it, they were talking about, you know, what else can we do. And the next year they created a little short tour called Elephant Six Holiday Surprise Tour that featured 15 artists and 10 Elephant Six bands, which, man, I really wish I would have known about that and been able to see that.
Me too.
Because I didn't know anything about that. Olivia Tremor Control reunited in 2009. Mm-hmm. And again, shortly after that, Jeff Mangum kind of came out of his self, whatever you want to call it, where he was out of the public's eye, and started playing some solo shows and things like that. But then unfortunately, it kind of all came to a grinding halt again in 2012, because Bill Doss, one of the original four Elephant Six members, he passed away from an aneurysm, and it kind of took everything that, you know, the momentum that they were, you know, bringing or had behind them again, and, you know, ground everything to a halt. And they kind of stopped producing any records and stopped doing anything. And Robert Schneider had said at the time, you know, he can't say that it means that it's the end of the Elephant Six or Apples in Stereo, but he just can't really come to terms with the loss and continue doing anything musically for a while. So that was not really the end. It didn't really ever end. It still happened. You know, there's still bands, but it's just not what it was there during that awesome period of the mid-90s to the very early 2000s, where it seemed like they could do anything and everything was going to be amazing and awesome.
Yeah, it really was a halcyon period for this group of musicians. And I can understand. I mean, it must have been horribly devastating to have one of the core members die at, you know, a relatively young age like that, and also very similar to the ages of the other musicians. So, you know, it must have been just, it shakes you very deeply when somebody who's close to your age passes away unexpectedly. And it's obviously, even with an artist, it's got to be a lot more difficult to deal with than a lot of other things.
So, right.
But even though there's kind of a sad ending to it, it doesn't in any way, of course, diminish the wonderful music that they made. And there's so much to be discovered throughout all of this.
Exactly. And if you're interested in learning more, again, I mentioned a book that I'm in the middle of reading. It's called Endless, mm-hmm. Endless, A Lo-Fi History of the Elephant Six Mystery. It's really good. It's kind of where, I can't remember what they call it, but it's where they have people that were in the collective kind of talking about it. I don't remember what that type of literary function is, you know, where a book, it's really more
it's all like a verbal history of some kind or something.
Correct. Yeah. So we'll maybe cut that out. Endless, Lo-Fi History of the Elephant Six Mystery. It's like a verbal history where a lot of the mm-hmm. surviving members talk about their experiences, and it's a really, really good book. I just haven't been able to finish it yet, but I really enjoy it. There also is a documentary that I have yet to be able to see called The Elephant Six Recording Company, and this is as Elephant Six as it gets. They made this movie in 2019, and the only way you could watch it to begin with was to rent a VHS copy from like one or two places that had the movie. So you couldn't. It's not streaming anywhere right now. It is, though, making its rounds through a bunch of film festivals. So it's still happening right now. So if you go to elephant6movie.com, there is a list of upcoming screenings. They have screenings all the way from April of 2023 through July of 2023. So you can watch it there. I believe it was streaming at one point, but it was only for a week, and you had to like get, it was almost like you had to check out the ability to watch it, and I missed it. So I'm hoping one day it does come out on DVD or on a streaming service to be able to watch this because the minute and a half trailer that they did release is awesome. So
it is cool.
But yeah, if you want more information on Elephant Six, there's a ton of information out there about the Elephant
Six. There is. There's definitely a good rabbit hole you can go down, and it's definitely interesting to do so. And you're right, that is so Elephant Six, that there was such a coded kind of a way that you had to do it.
But VHS
I can also see. Yeah, I can also see the fun in, you know, if you got lucky enough to live near somewhere where they were screening it, you know, to go with a friend or a couple of people who are into the music, it might be a fun journey too.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah. If
all right. Well, this has been great, Scott. Thank you so much.
Welcome.
This is a nice overview of what Elephant Six is, and as we mentioned, we'll definitely put together some episodes on the individual groups, because for sure a group like Beulah needs to have its story told a little bit, and there's so many cool songs that we want to hear that we could put in these episodes too to share for people, and we can go on and on about it, but once we play a few clips, you know, we'll probably you'll be out there streaming everything too. And what would you say, I mean, you were talking about the playlist you put together and you try to compile, I mean, would you say the majority of the stuff is up there, or you know, how would you assess
it? I would say you probably can stream on any of your streaming services somewhere probably around 80-85% of all of the stuff that I've at least been able to determine were considered Elephant Six. So I would say, the vast majority is there. All of the major bands are there. There are some like little side projects that I've never even heard any of the music from, and they're not available on streaming services. My assumption is you could probably find them on YouTube. I haven't gone there yet because I'm still trying to get through all of the music that that is available. But the majority of it is available to stream.
And sort of the bigger figures are out there, at least as far as I know, as well. So you can definitely hear some of the cornerstone records.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. All right. Well, that is your introduction to Elephant Six, folks, from Scott Parks and myself. And I hope you found that intriguing, especially if you haven't heard some of these groups. I really think, as far as our Rock in the Suburbs listenership goes, that it'll be right in your alley. You know, some of the influences in some of the bands that went far in our American Band Madness poll certainly share influences with the Elephant Six people, without a doubt.
Well, and if you've ever been scared off of Elephant Six because of Neutral Milk Hotel, because they do have, you know, Mangum has a certain sound, you will be very, very pleased to hear that the majority of it is really not like that, and has more of a 60s pop sensibility with a little bit of weirdness thrown in. And so if you like that, the weirder side of things, but you also like your stuff treacly sweet, it's going to be right up your alley.
Yeah, exactly right. And I'll tell you a quick anecdote. I used to play DJ at a small Catholic school in Arlington that our kids went to. And of course, anyone who has sent their kids to, or you're in any kind of organization that's, you know, kind of supported by the parents, anytime they figure out that you can do something and they're happy to ask you to help, and you always want to contribute. And for me, like DJing at, you know, fundraising events and dances, sure, I'll do that. But I used to play Apples and Cereal all the time, and there was no interruption in the groove, so I could slide it right in there between a lot of stuff, and it would totally hit with
exactly
the Catholic school parents. And it's got that kind of goodness to it. Yeah. So it's really, really good stuff. And so, yeah, stay tuned. We're going to be working on some episodes on the individual groups and maybe a couple other things. So thanks, Scott, for starting us down this road. Yep. I think people are going to really like
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You got it. Anytime. And folks, if you want to get in touch about Elephant Six, certainly you can do that. You can find us on the social medias at Suburbs Pod. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube, I believe. And also, if you want to send us an email or get in touch, our email address is rock@suburbspod.com. And you can always call up our Suburban Party line, which I just checked earlier, and there is quite a lot of activity on there. So I need to get to it and get through some of the voicemails and calls that are in there. That number is
612-440-1984.
Thank you, sir. And I am Patrick Foster, and with me has been
Scott Parks.
And we will talk to you guys later.
Amazing and awesome.